Inside Lacrosse Podcast.
Welcome to part two of the Inside Lacrosse Division 3 Playoff Podcast. After getting the lay of the land at the tournament field, now we're going to talk a little bracketology. So as Coach Kadelka pointed out, the 2019 field will be broken into 19 AQs, 5 Pool B bids, and 5 Pool C bids. Those 19 AQs will be split between the Capital Athletic Conference, the Centennial Conference, the Colonial States Athletic Conference, the MAC Commonwealth Conference, the Commonwealth Coast Conference, the Empire 8, the Great Northeast Athletic Conference, the Landmark, the Liberty League, the Little East, the Michigan Intercollegiate Athletic Association, the Midwest Lacrosse Conference, the NESCAC or New England Small College Athletic Conference, the North Atlantic Conference, the North Coast Athletic Conference, the Old Dominion Athletic Conference or ODAC, the Pilgrim League, the Skyline Conference, and the SUNYAC or State University of New York Athletic Conference. So first, D3 notebook writer Ken Stockman will give his take on the 19 AQ races. Then, popular forum commenter D3 will give his typically highly accurate prognostication on the 5 remaining Pool B and 5 Pool C bids that round out the field. So joining me now is Inside Lacrosse's D3 notebook writer Ken Stockman to kind of look at some of the more interesting conference races. Obviously, we can't break down all 19 AQs right now. That could be a pretty long conversation. But maybe we can dive into, you know, are there certain conferences, Ken, you're looking at right now that are a little more interesting heading into these AQ bids in terms of, you know, really a deep field or an unexpected team kind of in the lead? Or you think that, you know, that conference may just have a bigger ripple effect across some of the Pool C or you know, B bids themselves, depending on how some of these conferences break?
A few of them I was looking at that are potential conferences that have Pool C's come out of there. You know, there are a few conferences where clearly there's just going to be one team coming out. You know, some of the ones that aren't quite as deep. But the Sentinel, for sure. You know, Dickinson, the number two team in the country right now, undefeated. But in that conference, you have Washington College and Gettysburg are both two teams that, you know, potentially could upset them. And then, you know, obviously Dickinson would be grabbing one of those Pool C bids. And then to look a little bit further, you have the Empire 8 where you have Stevens, who has been ranked real high all year. And then, you know, Nazareth knocked him off pretty decisively a couple weeks ago. And now they're the number one seed in the conference. But again, you know, they're another conference that might, you know, it could go either way. And the loser could potentially snag one of those Pool C bids for sure. Looking a little further, you know, you have the ODAC, where you have Lynchburg and Roanoke are both very good teams. You know, they probably will both be in there regardless of the outcome, but also could be easily upset by one of the teams below them.
I'll gather, you know, some conferences kind of look like you almost locks from the outset here. I mean, I would look at it, you know, the CAC Salisbury traditionally takes that. I think they're in a good spot again this year, though that's a more competitive conference this year than it may have been in years past. You know, the MAC Commonwealth looks like it's Stevenson's to have. The AC is, you know, Cabrini's likely. The SUNYAC should go to Cortland. You know, Pilgrim, I've heard a lot to Springfield. I mean, do any of those sound more or less accurate to you? Or, you know, do you think any of those may kind of present interesting wrinkles in terms of what may play out?
Out of those ones you mentioned there, for sure Springfield's a lock in the Pilgrim, and Cabrini's a lock in the CFAC AC. But like you said, Salisbury, you know, it's an interesting game against St. Mary's coming up this weekend. They do have the potential to upset them, but, you know, it seems to me that Salisbury is really turning it on at the right time here. And then the other one you mentioned, I believe, was the SUNYAC. And Cortland's, you know, the number one team in the country, but the one team that they gave them a little bit of fits this year was actually Plattsburgh State, who only lost to them by 3. So there is the upset potential if, you know, Cortland might be looking past them. I don't know if that would be something, you know, that's nothing we've seen from them in the past. You know, they always seem very well prepared. And, you know, at this point with the perfect season going, I wouldn't think they'd take anybody lightly. But, you know, Plattsburgh is a team that might have that potential to score in numbers. They play very fast up and down, and, you know, they could catch you off guard for sure.
I guess some of the, you know, you could maybe call them smaller conferences that I found a little intriguing in the mix were, you know, like the Skyline. It seems to be, you know, a battle between Montclair and Keene, or Kane, I guess, rather, and with, you know, the geographic proximity of those two schools, both being really close to each other in northern New Jersey, that kind of is an interesting game to play out. The Commonwealth Coast seems to likely be, you know, a battle between Endicott and Western New England College. You know, some of those kind of conferences. I mean, maybe they tend to get overlooked in the greater field, but are there some interesting storylines kind of growing out of any of those?
Yeah, definitely. I like the Skyline Conference, like you mentioned there. I mean, Montclair's pretty much been the mainstay coming out of there for a while, ever since Stevens left a few years back. But Keene, I mean, they went on what I believe was a 13-game win streak this year, and Montclair was one of those teams, was the team to knock them off, but, you know, certainly they know how to win. They could be the one to upset Montclair and jump into the tournament this year. Endicott, Western New England, I think that's going to be a great game. You know, they definitely, you know, it was a decent game when they played earlier in the year. It should be, again, I would expect them to meet in the finals. You know, it could go either way for sure. I think regardless of who wins that, I think that's a one team conference as far as getting into the NCAA. So that game should be really interesting. A lot of people should be paying attention to that. And then, you know, in one conference that's already taken place already, the championship with the NCAC, you know, for Ohio Wesleyan to come up and sneak and pull that upset over Denison was pretty, you know, pretty surprising, I would think, to most people. There sits Denison, you know, with a great record, but not much of a schedule this year, not much of a resume for the to make the tournament. I think they're probably going to be left out.
An interesting conference to me was the Liberty League. It was a very competitive conference all year. And, you know, maybe it didn't play out quite as I thought, but, you know, RIT has been talked about as a potential 2 seed in the North. And, you know, they look to be in control of the Liberty, but, I mean, do you feel that's a pretty confident situation for them, that they'll likely take that? Or what do you think the odds of maybe, you know, a Union, a St. Lawrence, somebody like that kind of being able to steal that bit away?
Well, this past weekend, I mean, St. Lawrence came out to Rochester, and it was a one-goal game. You know, they very easily could have taken that game this weekend, and I don't see, you know, why they couldn't do put themselves in position to take the win this Sunday in the Liberty League Finals if they do get past Clarkson. You know, as far as the semifinals go, the Clarkson St. Lawrence game could be a good one. Those are two schools that aren't separated by all that very big a distance. I'm pretty much in the same town. You know, so it's always a good game when they play a rivalry game. But you know, if St. Lawrence wins, as I expect they'll do, you know, that could be quite the matchup this Sunday out here in Rochester.
The ODAC is another kind of interesting one that, you know, W&L and Lynchburg kind of jumped out of the gate and looked like maybe the class of that league. And then, you know, all of a sudden Roanoke, after kind of, you know, going back and forth in the early part of the year, goes on a tear and beats both of them and, you know, sits atop the league currently. I mean, how do you think that one might break out, especially because that league feels like it's going to have pretty heavy influence on the eventual Pool C bids?
Yeah, that's that could go to any of those teams you mentioned there, Roanoke, Washington Lee, Lynchburg, and, you know, Hampton Sydney's got the upset potential too. They could, you know, jump up and surprise some people. You know, they upset Lynchburg earlier in the year, and, you know, they could do that again. That wouldn't surprise anyone, I don't think. But, you know, and Roanoke is a team that, like you said, came on real late this year. They were a team I wrote about in the middle of the season for the mid-season type D3 notebook I put out, and I put them as one of the teams that were underperforming. You know, they had lost to St. Mary's again. They kind of seemed like they were down this year on a team that a lot of people were high on coming into the season. But, you know, between them, Washington, Lee, and Lynchburg, it's really a toss-up. Washington and Lee, you know, later in the season, a couple losses, you know, to Roanoke, to Lynchburg, to Washington College, which is a bit of a surprise at the time. But, you know, they beat Salisbury earlier in the year, and, you know, they definitely got the potential.
Another one that I found kind of interesting was, or maybe surprising, was, to see Naz sitting on top of the Empire 8, mostly because, going into the year, it seemed there was more buzz behind a team like Stevens or maybe even an Ithaca, and now, Naz seems to be in control, though Stevens and Ithaca obviously have a good shot there. I mean, what are your sense of that one, maybe in terms of playing the chalk or potentially, playing to an upset?
I think that one there is a toss-up between Stevens and Nazareth. I was really surprised when I saw the game against Stevens and they beat him 17-8 when Stevens was so much higher ranked. And I don't even believe that Nazareth was ranked at the time. And then you get a team, Nazareth that lost to Geneseo earlier in the year. You're really not sure what you're going to get, but it could go either way. Stevens has a what I still believe to be the best midfield in the country, and to beat anyone. But, the couple losses they've had, aside from getting blown out by Nazareth, which was completely surprising, was to the court win and to touch two of the top teams in the country. So I still think it's Stevens' conference to lose, whether they have to come up to Rochester and take it from Naz or not. But and then again, if Naz doesn't win that game, I think they're a team that'll be sitting home probably come playoff time because of that one loss to Geneseo. That's really going to kill them, I think.
And then, kind of the perennially interesting conference is the NESCAC. I mean, every year it's a very deep conference. It's, overall top to bottom competitive. It's also a very big conference tournament field. Eight teams advance on to the conference tournament. They already played the first round this past weekend. We're left with Wesleyan, Middlebury, Tufts, Connecticut College. All four of those teams kind of have cases to be made for the playoffs, particularly, if maybe Wesleyan pulls an upset on Middlebury. I mean, I could see any of those teams making the field or any of those teams sitting home, come May. So, what is your sense maybe on how the NESCAC may play out?
I think Tufts needs to make it to at least the championship to get in there. I mean, they're a great team. I'm not sure clearly they started the season, with the suspensions and they lost to Connecticut by only one goal, with missing 27 of their players. But I did watch that game and it was in, absolute downpour and the conditions weren't great. And since then, Connecticut's found, themselves a great goalie. So I think that's going to be a great matchup. And the Wesleyan Middlebury game, Wesleyan's had a good year. I just don't think that Middlebury seems to be clicking too much right now. I don't think they have what it takes to get by them. And I think without beating Middlebury in the semis there, I don't think they have much of a resume to make it to the tournament. A couple losses and, especially that Bates loss is probably going to hurt them a little bit. But, if there was an upset, I wouldn't be greatly surprised. But I think, Middlebury's just playing the best ball right now out of all the NESCAC teams. And Tufts, certainly have the players to put it together, but they just don't seem to be clicking right now either.
And obviously, once all these AQs are sorted out, the full field gets built. The bracket gets split to a north and south. I mean, do you have a sense of maybe which path may seem like an easier path to championship this year? Working your way through the north or through the south. I mean, the north has probably had the most consistent team all year in terms of obviously Cortland is the only undefeated squad left. But I've heard a lot of talk that the south is probably overall deeper. I heard someone say the year of the south. I mean, do you get that sense that while the north may have one or two real power teams, the south feels almost more of a competitive field from top to bottom?
I would say, it's pretty even right now. And the reason I say that is I think that the South is going to wind up with a bunch of the Pool B teams. And really, the Pool B teams this year, with them being five of them, the quality of them is just not going to be great. So with five teams down there that, wouldn't necessarily, don't have the resumes to make the tournament with, under Pool C guidelines and stuff and kind of, get in there because they're independents or what have you. I think that's five teams that are easily, going to get run over in the first round. But then in the north, you've got the conferences that don't really turn out great teams. You've got the great Northeast. You've got, the Little East, North Atlantic. I think it's fairly, those are teams that are comparable to those Pool B teams that are just, sort of easy outs for them. you know, the mainstays in the tournament each year. You know, if they match up with a, you know, a team from the Empire Eight or the Liberty, you know, I don't think they stand much of a chance, you know, much like the Pool Bs in the South. So I would say, you know, it's going to be pretty comparable.
And obviously this is hard to do, you know, without even the tournament field being selected yet, let alone, you know, seeing any games played. But, you know, I mean, right now, just kind of maybe pulling a rabbit out of a hat, you know, who do you expect to see squaring off in Philly on in the Division III title game?
The teams I went with in the beginning of the year were Stevenson and Cortland, and I'm probably going to stay that way. I think, you know, Cortland's the best team in the North I've seen so far. They're just deep everywhere. Probably the best player in the country in Joseph Laddick. And down south, Stevenson, the defense is unreal. They got their goalie back now from the injury. He was playing great prior to that. The attack can put up some numbers, and the defense is just so, so good. And I think those are definitely the teams that are going to be seeing come Memorial Day weekend.
All right, well, Ken, thanks a lot for, you know, kind of breaking those AQs. You know, you've been writing our D3 notebook all year. Will we expect to see kind of one more post before we head into Selection Sunday here?
Yeah, the next one will be coming out Thursday.
All right, well, I'll be looking forward to read that, Ken. Thanks a lot for coming on and talking a little bit of the AQs with me.
Anytime. Thanks a lot, Zach.
Take care. All right, well, as we learned from the preceding interview with Coach Kadelka, there are going to be 10 bids split between Pools B and Pool C for teams that don't earn automatic qualifiers, 5 to Pool B, 5 to Pool C. I'm pleased to be joined now, a bit of a surprise guest for us, a man who's well-known amongst the online D3 forums, is a bit of a savant for being able to pick accurately the Division III tournament from year to year, a man who simply goes by the commenter name of D3. We're going to maintain that anonymity for today's podcast so he can kind of speak a little freely with us about, you know, his thoughts on what the tournament may play out to be. So D3, I want to talk to you about, I guess, mostly those Pool B and C bids. Obviously, there's a handful of teams kind of vying for them. I guess we can start with Pool C, or rather Pool B. Pool B, it seems like, will be teams from MAC Freedom, the NEAC, the NECC, the SCAC, the SAA, and all their independents left. I saw on a recent post you had that I believe you were thinking Otterbein, Eastern, Center, Suwannee, Cayuga, Colorado College, Christopher Newport's were kind of maybe the front runners in that mix for the Pool B bids. I guess, can you give me your thoughts on who the Pool B field may be and who the eventual 5 bids may go to?
Sure, and thanks for having me on, Zach. Appreciate it. I think it's great that you guys are doing a little bit of D3 coverage with these podcasts. I've been following along, so I was happy to come on and help when you extended the invitation. Pool B is actually is pretty easy to figure out. It essentially narrows down to 7 teams out of those conferences and the independents that you mentioned, and like you said, the teams I had listed in a recent post are the ones that are really in play. You've got really 2 different groups of teams within Pool B. You've got Christopher Newport, Suwannee, Centre, Colorado College, and Otterbein, who have extraordinarily similar resumes for the tournament in the sense that they've all got about the same winning percentage, and similar strengths of schedule. Christopher Newport's being the exception there. Their winning percentage is actually quite low. They're only 8-7 in region, but they happen to have the strongest strength of schedule of these teams competing. And perhaps more importantly, they also have a win against a regionally ranked opponent in Hampton, Sydney. Of all the Pool B teams in Division III, they're one of 2 teams that have a win against a regionally ranked opponent, so that kind of separates them. Suwannee is the other team that has a win against a regionally ranked opponent, and that was when they beat Virginia Wesleyan. So there's not a lot of quality in Pool B, so it's really just kind of looking at these resumes, knowing what the committee likes in past years, and then trying to separate the teams. And then the second group in Pool B is Cayuga and Eastern. And on its face, I think most people think Eastern's probably the best Pool B team out there in terms of the fact that they took Gettysburg to overtime and and they're probably going to be 15-2 heading into the tournament. But unfortunately for them, their strength of schedule is extremely weak. It falls outside of the top 100 in D3. The same for Keuka. They're going to end up with the best win-loss percentage of this group, but they're going to have the worst strength of schedule of this group. So the way I kind of approached it was the two resumes that are the most complete, so to speak, of the Pool Bs are Christopher Newport and Suwannee. They both got winning percentages over 500. They've got two of the strongest strength of schedules, and they both have a regionally ranked win. That's going to separate them from the group, and there's five bids to go around and only seven teams to select from. So I think when the committee is on their conference call on Sunday, those two teams are going to kind of be able to differentiate themselves from the rest of the group. So that leaves you with Otter Bean, Centre, Colorado College, Eastern, and Keuka. And, I've been analyzing these brackets for years. I know how the committee thinks and what happens in those rooms. And if there's one thing that you learn, it's that strength of schedule overrides almost everything. The committee is simply just not going to be impressed with 15-2 records if you play a weak schedule, because in their mind, a team that played a more difficult schedule but only went, 11-4 or something like that, they could have easily gone 15-2 as well if they played the weaker schedule. So I wouldn't say it's clear cut by any means, but I think that the committee is going to go with the Otter Bean, Centre, Colorado College group over the Keuka and Eastern groups because of strength of schedule. There's a wide enough divide there between the schedules that Keuka and Eastern played and the rest of the teams. So I think when it's all said and done, the two that are left out are Keuka and Eastern.
Well, it sounds like, I guess, then the more divisive maybe debate may be around the Pool B bids. There's a lot more teams that kind of fall into there, and a lot more might be recognizable names that have made some waves, across the D3 schedule, maybe during the course of the spring here. From what I last saw, you were running online, you were throwing in teams like Washington College, Washington and Lee, Middlebury, Lynchburg, Stevens, Plattsburgh, Connecticut College, York, Franklin and Marshall, and St. Lawrence, all is potentially in that kind of Pool C, pool, I guess. And that's almost just considering, I guess, a lot of the other AQ conferences play to chalk. If they kind of start to fall and break odd ways, you're going to see different teams kind of come and go from that Pool C bid. I guess before we even talk about, who those teams are, I mean, you've been handicapping these fields for a while. With the split of 5 Pool B and 5 Pool C, does this feel a particularly difficult year to kind of be able to carve yourself out one of those Pool C bids?
Yeah, absolutely. Due to the way the NCAA reformulated the D3 lacrosse field this year, and the allocations were changed so that Pool B added some bids, and Pool C, which had two extra bids last year, there was 7 in Pool C, is down to 5. So when you get this kind of split, I mean, make no mistake about it, the Pool B teams, no matter who they are going to be the 3, 4, 5, the 5 lowest seeds in the South or the North, while the Pool C teams are legitimate, Final Four contenders, potentially national championship contenders if there's some bad breaks in the AQ conferences. So it's going to be really difficult to get a Pool C bid this year. I'm expecting by the time Sunday comes around that there's going to be at least one or two eye-popping teams that are left out of the field that are potentially even sitting in the top 5 in the country right now in the Coaches Bowl. It's extremely difficult, and when you look at the numbers, there's a lot of teams with very similar resumes. It's going to come down to one or two games, and one or two games that might have been played in early March or late February that are going to be the difference. So there's no question that Pool C is where most of the attention is going to be for the selection show on Sunday night.
So I guess, you know, when we do the D1 bracketology posts online, we tend to kind of clip at the end a first in, first out kind of thing. So I guess, you know, looking at that Pool C, you know, group of teams, who do you see as kind of maybe having the most convincing resumes to date so far, and maybe even glimpsing slightly ahead in terms of potentially how their play in a conference tournament may factor in? You know, who looks like most likely to be able to grab a Pool C bid right now?
Yeah, I think as we were sitting here, I was just kind of scribbling some stuff down, and I think the best way to do this is kind of I kind of just cut them up into tiers. You know, when I do the posts online, I kind of have to pick who I think is going to win the automatic qualifier, and that obviously might not necessarily be the case. So, you know, in kind of answering your question, I think sitting here today, there are three locks for the tournament, meaning that if they fall in their conference tournaments, they're going to get Pool C bids. I can't see any way that they would be denied. And that's RIT, Cortland, and Dickinson. Those three teams all have superior win-loss percentages, strengths of schedule, and excellent records against regionally ranked opponents. And I think that even if they happen to fall in their conferences, that they'll lock up Pool C bids no matter what happens elsewhere. So I know their coaches won't be sending this message to the players, but they can pretty much punch their ticket already. And then after the locks, you've kind of got the next tier of teams, which I've determined are Salisbury, Roanoke, Stevenson, Nazareth, and surprisingly, I think to a lot of people, Tufts. You know, Tufts is a team that's has gotten a lot of press this year for the right reasons and the wrong reasons. And, you know, they lost two games early in the year, and you can guarantee that those two games will be considered by the committee equal to any other games that they played, despite the fact that they were playing with, you know, 27 players suspended. But even accounting for those games, they've got an excellent winnings percentage. If they fall in NESCAC, they'll be probably 12-4. They've got a strength of schedule that's in the top tier, and then they'll be probably 6-3 against regionally ranked opponents, which I can tell you, compared to the rest of the Pool C field, is at the top of the list, you know, other than probably RIT, Cortland, and Dickinson. The other teams, Salisbury, Roanoke, Stevenson, and Naz, have all put together similar resumes. They're just very well-rounded in terms of their winning percentage is high quality. It's not at the level, obviously, of a Cortland or a Dickinson, who are both undefeated, but they have high win-loss percentages, excellent strengths of schedules, and they've done well enough against regionally ranked opponents. One thing to keep in mind with regionally ranked opponents is it's not necessarily your win-loss record against regionally ranked opponents. Like going 6-3 is really no better than going 6-6 against regionally ranked opponents. They're really just kind of looking at quality wins when they're looking at your results against regionally ranked opponents. And in fact, I'd argue that a 6-6 record against regionally ranked opponents is better than, say, a 6-3 record, because it showed that you played more high-quality teams. So anyway, that group of teams are all in Tier 1. Now, you'll note that there's, between the locks, there's RIT, Cortland, Dickinson, and then you get to Tier 1, you've got Salisbury, Roanoke, Tufts, Stevenson, and Naz. You're already up to 8 teams. So you're getting into the danger zone now, where if a lot of these heavy favorites start to fall in their conference tournaments to the underdogs, then these Pool C bids are going to get gobbled up really quickly. After that, we get into, I've kind of separated into Tier A and Tier 2A and 2B, because it's two different groups of teams based on the resume. Tier 2A are some very well-known teams, WNL, Washington College, Lynchburg. The winner of the Franklin and Marshall Gettysburg tournament game, and Stevens out of the EA. Again, all these teams have similar resumes. They all went about 4-4 or 5-5 against regionally ranked opponents. Their winning percentages are in the 700s, and their strength of schedules are all very similar, if not identical. And then you've got Tier 2B, which surprisingly, Middlebury is in that tier, and I think a lot of people are sort of defaulting that even if they fall in the NCAA and the NESCAC tournament that they're going to get a bid. But their resume, it definitely worries me. That's difficult for me to say personally, but their strength of schedule is outside of these other teams I've mentioned. It falls a level below that. And they've also only gone 2-2 against regionally ranked opponents. Contrast, I would say, a Lynchburg who by the time this the ODAC tournament's over, is probably going to be 5-5 against regionally ranked opponents. That's a big difference, playing 10 games against regionally ranked opponents compared to 4. So Middlebury is a team that's in a lot of trouble if they don't win the NESCAC. And then the other team that kind of sits side by side with Middlebury, perhaps a little bit behind them, is Denison, who just was upset in their tournament, and that's our first example of what we're going to see, which is these heavy favorites losing. And I think it's a real stretch to imagine Denison making the tournament. They'd only get in as if we had pure chalk in the conference tournaments. And even then, I have a tough time believing they'd be one of the first 5. As of now, they're only 1-2 against regionally ranked opponents. Their only hope is if Ohio Wesleyan shows up in this week's rankings, which come out tomorrow afternoon, that would bump them up to 2-3 against regionally ranked opponents, but I still don't see that being enough. And then finally, we've got the Tier 3 teams, which is Plattsburgh, St. Lawrence, Connecticut College, St. Mary's, York, and the Franklin Marshall Gettysburg loser. These are teams that had, good years, historic years in some cases, like Plattsburgh and York, for their programs. But ultimately, it's not going to be enough to get them into the tournament. A team like Towne College has a chance if they can beat Tufts in the semis of the NESCAC and then lose to Middlebury in the finals. That might be enough to bump them up a tier or two. I personally just don't see that happening. So that's why I've got them in Tier 3. And that's it. I mean, that's pretty much the universe of teams. Now, keep in mind, I'm kind of using the win-loss percentage, strength of schedule, and regional rankings as kind of the guideline here. But there are obviously other factors. Probably the most important one is head-to-head. And that's going to cause some teams to move ahead of others, even if they've got a slightly worse resume. And you look at a team like Tufts, using them as an example again, they've beaten Stevenson, they've beaten Stevens, they've beaten Middlebury. They've got a solid resume, and the head-to-head component really puts them in a great position if they can't get the AQ.
Okay, so now between your top tier and your tier one, pretty much, RIT, Cortland, Dickinson, Salisbury, Roanoke, Stevenson and Naz are all more or less right now either sitting in first place or even Tufts is, I think, in second place in NESCAC. So they're all either in first or second place. And, assuming they play out to win their respective AQs, I gather, do you just kind of think it'll fall amongst how you have it of, we'll almost kind of default to the 5 pool C bids falling to your 5 tier 2A teams? Or I guess, do you almost even have a sense beyond that of what conferences seem more likely to play to chalk as compared to, throw a wrench in this whole thing?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. I think that, realistically, I'd assume that Salisbury and Stevenson both win their conferences. Same with Cortland, RIT. Those are teams that seem to be a clear step ahead of the rest of the teams in their conferences. I can envision a scenario, even though Dickinson's undefeated, where they don't get through the Centennial tournament because it's such a difficult tournament and conference, and those teams are all scraping for Pool C bids, so they really need to pump their resumes up. And same with Roanoke. Obviously, W&L and Lynchburg and even Hampton-Sydney are all quality opponents, so I could see them falling as well. And Naz will have to face the winner of Stevens-Ithaca, which will be a stiff challenge as well. And then, you know, you've got the Middlebury, Tufts, College, Wesleyan group in the NESCAC, which, you know, I think maybe you default to Middlebury because the tournament's going to be up in Vermont, but that's about it in terms of the way you'd separate those teams. But to kind of play along, if you know, if you assume that those locks and tier one teams all kind of win their conferences, then, you know, yeah, to answer your question, I think you'd be looking at that tier A, 2A and 2B group, which is, you know, again, it's W&L, Washington College, Lynchburg, Franklin and Marshall, Gettysburg, Winter, Stevens, and then Middlebury and Denison. And then, you know, just seeing how these things have played out in the past, I think that W&L, Washington College, and Lynchburg have kind of separated themselves from the rest just in terms of their overall resume and the number of regionally ranked opponents they've played and defeated. They'd all probably be about 5-5 or 4-4 against regionally ranked opponents by the time Sunday comes along. So that would leave you with two bids between the Franklin and Marshall, Gettysburg Winter, Stevens, Middlebury, and Denison. I think I already said I don't feel confident in Denison getting a bid. I think they would drop out, and then that leaves you with three teams for two spots. Middlebury will have the best winning percentage. They're over 800, even with a loss in the NESCAC. But again, they'll have the least number of regionally ranked wins and the weakest strength of schedule. And time and again, you've seen that in past years be the difference maker. That said, you know, if it comes down to them and say Franklin and Marshall or Gettysburg, you know, Middlebury's winning percentage is substantially better than those teams. I think Franklin and Marshall has six losses and Gettysburg will have six or seven as well, and Middlebury would only have three. So I think, you know, at that point, the committee, you know, might say that Middlebury's got the more well-rounded resume. And it's one of those things that I'll probably have a better idea on Sunday afternoon of who's going to get the bid when the final numbers are calculated, because, you know, strength of schedule, for example, is constantly changing. Every game that's played between now and then influences it. So, you know, for purposes of Wednesday's podcast, I'd say, you know, if chalk grained in the tournaments, you'd be looking at W&L, Washington College, Lynchburg, Stevens, and then it would probably come down to the winner of Middlebury and F&M Gettysburg, you know, and seeing where the final strength of schedule numbers came out. And kind of the X factor in all this is that tomorrow is the final release of the regional rankings. And if you see a team like Wesleyan pop up into those rankings, that'll be a huge boost for Middlebury, because they have already defeated Wesleyan once and they're playing them again on Saturday. So that would give them the chance to add two more wins against a regionally ranked opponent. And at that point, I'd probably even move them close to tier one. So that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. It's such a fine line between these different groups, and it really is going to come down to that final weekend. But I'd pay close attention to those regional rankings tomorrow night and see if Wesleyan pops up onto them, or in the South, if Ohio Wesleyan pops in, which would be a big boost for Denison.
And I know on part of your kind of prognostication post here, you also kind of break down what you think the potential layout of the tournament might be in terms of, you know, seeding and potential matchups. I mean, obviously, that's a lot of nuance to really dissect completely now, but, you know, do you have a sense of, when I talked to Coach Kadelka about the breakdown of the field, you know, there's 29 teams, three are going to get opening round byes, it sounds like, and then, you know, the rest will line up in one way or another. Do you have a sense of who you think will earn those three opening round byes, and from there maybe, you know, who the top five or six teams in the North, top five or six teams in the South, you know, may be in terms of seeding?
Yeah, well, you know, if listening to what we just talked about, you know, I kind of think it's going to be the year of the South, so to speak, in the sense that they're going to eat up most of the Pool B and Pool C bids, which makes for a really crowded South bracket, which I think means that there's only going to be one bye in the South, because you've got to fill a number of slots. So you'd be looking at two byes in the North and then only one in the South. And You know, I think in terms of the buys, you'd be looking at Corlin and Dickinson are essentially locked into buys at this point. And then RIT looks like a strong number two seed in the North, and I think they're going to get a first-round buy as well. And then, you know, after that, I've always said since I was posting these brackets, you know, way back at the beginning of probably the late 90s, I don't even know, that, you know, it's obviously much easier to pick the teams in the field than to select the matchups, because all it takes is the committee on that day on the conference call to see one thing different than what I see, and, you know, it can mix up every potential matchup. But, you know, things to really pay attention to are, you know, kind of those tiers I laid out, the locks and the tier one teams are probably going to be, you know, the 1, 2, 3, 4 seeds in each bracket, the North and the South. And then, you know, that the other pool C teams that get in would be, you know, the higher seeds, 4, 5, and 6 in each bracket. And then after that, more important than seeding, what you really want to do is consider geography, because the NCAA has stated many times that overrides any seeding, and they don't want to pay for teams to fly. It's obviously more expensive than putting a team on a couple buses, so they only have to fly a team somewhere if the games are 500 miles or more apart. So the committee is going to be forced to make sure that these matchups, to the extent possible, all are 500 miles or less. And if that means bumping a team down a seat or two to maintain that, they'll do that. You know, it's hard to exactly predict how things are fall, but that's kind of generally. And then I'd say, you know, the only other kind of tidbit that's interesting is, you know, you've got at least one, if not two teams in Rochester, New York, who are going to make the tournament this year in RIT and NAS. And I've seen at least 3 or 4 times in past years, the NCAA loves to have the teams from the Midwest go to Rochester, because it's kind of a way around the system for them. And those teams in the Midwest are considered Southern teams in D3 lacrosse. But I think that you'll see a situation where one, if not two of them, like an Adrian from Michigan, or even a Cambrini from Pennsylvania, get pushed up to the northern bracket and have to travel to Rochester as a way for the committee to get around that 500-mile rule.
And, you know, you mentioned you've been doing these brackets since about the 90s. Have you ever been able to do any kind of calculations to figure out, you know, the level of accuracy they seem to have? I mean, the amount of times your posts were brought up to me by other people makes me think that a lot of people put a lot of stock in them. I didn't know if maybe you've ever tracked your progress to realize how well you tend to do in terms of either picking the teams or laying out much of the field in general.
I never have done the math or anything like that. There's, you know, but I guess I'd say that I think these posts are all archived on the internet, and someone could go back, and I think my record kind of speaks for itself. It's definitely not 100%. I know even last year I had whittled it down to a difference between Roanoke and Conn College for the 7th and final pool C slot. And I elected to go with Roanoke at the last minute, mainly because I guess I was listening to what other people were saying, and it was hard to imagine 4 NESCAC teams getting a bid, even though they had the better resume. But aside from that, that misselection, I've got to be close to 100%. You know, there's been years where, you know, I've had 7 lost Gettysburg and 7 lost Bowdoin teams in the pool C field when other people weren't even considering them as possibilities, and then sure enough their names were called on the selection day. So I don't know the numbers, but you know, I like to think that it's a source that people can use, and it kind of stands above the noise you hear. You know, there's always the uninformed newcomers who come along and scream and yell about the pool B and C bids and the seating, and, you know, I can kind of keep a measured measured post every year that people can kind of lean on. And I try to do it throughout the year so you kind of see where your team falls. And, you know, I get private messages and things from coaches asking me, you know, what they think of, you know, they need to do in upcoming weeks and, you know, how to schedule in future years and stuff like that. And I think it's a way for everyone to see behind the system, you know, based on my experiences in doing this. So.
And I guess, you know, maybe going on the furthest limb here, I mean, you've more or less laid out your odds on the field. Could you even ballpark maybe an idea of who you might expect to see playing in Philly on championship weekend? Or even, do you think this may be a year that we won't see Cortland, Salisbury, or both in Philly on championship weekend?
I wouldn't bet against it. I made a joke on one of the forums recently that, you know, you can give me, you know, Cortland, Salisbury, Tufts, and Middlebury, who I think have won the last 13 national championships combined, and I'd give someone else the other 200-plus teams in Division III, and I'd feel pretty good about my chances. You know, I think the reason that you see the same teams win in May is because of the experience that they build. You know, they've got seniors and juniors who have been doing it for years, and I know that, you know, when Middlebury went on its run back at the beginning of the decade, you know, one important factor was, you know, a team like that gets an extra month to play together under the high-pressure situations that other teams in their conference and region don't benefit from. So when you get into the next year, there's such a greater level of experience. So that's why you do see the same teams every year. But if I had to guess this year, I think that we're looking at, you know, in the South, I think a Dickinson, Stevenson, Final Four matchup. And then in the North, I wouldn't want to play Tufts. I know they've struggled at times, and, you know, they had a tumultuous start to their season. But I think talent, experience-wise, you know, they're right up there. And then, you know, Cortland is in the exact same boat. So I think when it's all said and done, it'll be those two teams again. And then, you know, so at least maybe we'll get away from Salisbury in the South, and then maybe the Cortland Tufts winner in the North. And then, you know, if I had to guess, I'd say Cortland Tufts winner in the North takes the championship in Philly, simply because they'd be going against a Dickinson-Stevenson winner that has never been there before. But it's an exciting year. I mean, I'd say you've got maybe seven or eight teams with a legitimate shot as opposed to two or three.
All right. Well, this interview will be airing on Wednesday. Can I guess, are you going to have maybe one more kind of a prognostication post before Sunday comes around, or just kind of wait and see what the field plays out to be?
What I'm planning to do is throw one up tomorrow evening after the final regional rankings. Well, I should say the final public really regional rankings are released. I want to see whether a team like Wesleyan pops in there, or Ohio Wesleyan. And I'll throw up a ranking, and then usually on Sunday I put one up middle of the day once the tournaments are over. I think the NESCAC ends at 2:00, so we'll know the AQ winner there, and I think that's the last tournament. And then I'll probably run through my numbers and, you know, compare head-to-head games and common opponents, things like that, and put up a final bracket sometime probably around like 6:00 on Sunday. And then I know that the selection show is at 10:00. So you know, I'll probably have at least two more posts, but they'll be, you know, brackets only. I probably won't be adding too much discussion at this point.
All right, well, I'll be curious to follow along with those and kind of see where you think your final, I guess, changes with the tournament field might be. I feel pretty good about it, I guess, after some of these conversations I've had here. So I guess I'll also kind of be watching on Sunday at around 7 to see who comes into the field. But thank you very much for, you know, letting me kind of step behind the curtain a little bit here and just get your thoughts on what the potential D3 field could be. And I think a lot of people will also be, like me, curious to see what your thoughts are and then what the NCAA Selection Committee's thoughts are come Sunday. So thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Zach.
Take care.
Take care. All right. Thanks.
Well, there you have a pretty thorough breakdown of all things Division III playoffs. Remember, the field will be announced at 10 o'clock on NCAA.com. Follow Inside Lacrosse all Sunday evening for complete NCAA tournament coverage of all levels. Next week, the podcast will continue to look ahead at the playoffs. Best luck to all teams competing for a shot at the playoffs this weekend. I'm sure there will be some sadness, but some surprises to come as well.
Inside Lacrosse Podcast.